recording from my living room in beautiful Marietta, Georgia. You are listening to the Think Inclusive Podcast, Episode 9, brought to you by Brooks Publishing Company. I'm your host, Tim Viegas. Today, I will be speaking with Russ Ewell, the CEO of Digital Scribbler, founder of Hope Technology Group, which started Hope Technology School, a nationally recognized full inclusion school, and founder of eSoccer, an all-volunteer inclusive soccer program. I had the pleasure of visiting with him one evening in November of last year. Russ and I discussed the beginnings of eSoccer and how, for all intents and purposes, it happened by accident. We also talk about how sports programs can become more inclusive when everyone has the right attitude and gets training on how to be proactive instead of reactive. Russ even makes me blush near the end of the interview, so make sure to listen to the entire podcast. So without further ado, let's get to the Think Inclusive Podcast. Thanks for listening. Joining us today on the Think Inclusive Podcast is Russ Ewell, the CEO of Digital Scribbler, which is the creator of the communication app QuickTalk AAC. He's also the founder of Hope Technology Group, which started Hope Technology School, a nationally recognized full inclusion school. And also, he's the founder of eSoccer, an all-volunteer inclusive soccer program dedicated to empowering both typical and special needs children of all abilities. Russ, thanks so much for taking some time to speak with us.
I'm excited to be here. It's a privilege to be on your podcast, and all the Think Inclusive work that you do inspires me.
Well, thanks, Russ. You are a man of many hats, that is for sure.
Yeah, I don't know how it happens to me, but yes.
I just read that description. It seems like, did you set out to start something like this, or how did this happen exactly?
Well, you know, I didn't set out to start any of these things. And, you know, my wife probably deserves the bulk of the credit. She's the executive director of Hope Technology School, and she's the real person who put it together. Hope Technology Group, which I work with, just pretty much, you know, raised the money and continues to support the work financially and in regard to technology. But basically, as a parent of special needs kids, of two who have special needs, I was looking for a way with my sons, my two boys. We have one typical child, but I was looking for a way to do something, a father-son kind of experience with them. This was in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s. And I joined some special needs sports, and they were enjoyable, and my son and I liked them. But having grown up as an athlete and experiencing all of the levels of athletics, I didn't realize until I became a parent that a big part of it is it's a family experience to do athletics, and it's a community experience to do athletics. So what I realized in the special needs sports I was involved in, we were off to a different side of the field or the court while everyone else was in another place with the typical children. That was very different, obviously, than how I grew up. And I wanted my kids to experience what I experienced, which is a complete, total community, which what we now, you and I both call inclusion. For me, it was just life. And because I was a typically developing kid. And so I came home one day. I remember it well. And I told my wife, I said, I just don't know how much longer I can do this. Because, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm looking and I'm going, I want my son to be with his friends who are in the typical program. So his friends would be with him all week long, and then they would leave him at time of sports. And I was like, I got to do something. But I didn't, you know, what was I going to do? There was you either belong to the special needs sport team, or you tried to be in the regular program, but there's no way, you know, he could sustain at the speed they were moving and all that. And so, long story made short, and I can come back to this, but I reached out to my friends who were all from neurotypical families and with neurotypical kids in development. And I didn't really realize it, but I happened to have about six friends who were all high-level soccer players. And I had been reading and studying, because I do that a lot. That's how I try to figure out what to do next, because today, as you all know, there's a lot of information for parents with special needs kids. But in the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, even before we came along in this experience, there wasn't as much, so you had to figure it out. Mm. And so I read that soccer was more popular worldwide, and many reasons they gave, because I thought soccer was totally boring. You know, you only scored like 1-0. And I was like, are you kidding me? I played basketball. And so I read it, and it said that one of the reasons is, one, it's not expensive. Two, foot-eye coordination comes faster than hand-eye coordination. And I thought about my own kids and how they were, and I thought, you know, I think this could be true. And so we launched into what eventually became eSoccer. Now, to answer your question, that's too long-winded there, but what happened is I just got my friends together and said, you know, I really want my kids to experience this. I knew everybody else was busy, but I had some friends. I had friends with kids, friends without kids, and we ended up across the street from my house at a middle school, getting about 15 of us out there with about, probably 20 of us out there with about 6 to 8 kids. And we just started doing little drills with soccer. And my big vision was anybody who volunteers that's a teenager or middle schooler will help them to become really good at soccer so they can play at the high school level or beyond. We want to help the typical kids, the special needs kids, to develop fine motor, gross motor, whatever we can up them in their development and give them friendships. And then the parent, you get to hang out on the sidelines, like a lot of parents do, and get to know other people and enjoy what really is a community experience. So I did that, and it started going. And I was happy. My kids were happy, and we had a nice small group. I think it topped out at 25, and everybody could be there on a Saturday. And then mother came by, and she was like, hey, can I be a part of this program? And I was like, well, it's not really a program. You know, we don't really have people joining, and let me think about it. And I went home and told my wife, I go, I don't really want to add people. We got it now. I'm not trying to start anything. And she said to me, are you really going to leave this, you know, poor mom all by herself with a kid, no help? And I felt so terrible that I said, okay, I'll let her in. That led to hundreds of more people joining over time. So everything I've done, the eSoccer, the software development, all these things have not been on purpose. They've been by necessity, by chance, and then I thought it was helping people. So that's sort of the answer to that. Sorry, it went so long there.
No. That's really interesting because, like you said, part of what inclusion is that community. Right. It really is best when it's kind of this organic thing that just happens, because you're not trying to force or, recreate this situation where, typical kids and kids with special needs are, put together and just it's supposed to magically happen. It was much more organic out of, like you said, necessity. So right. I think in that sense, it was easy to see that as being an authentic, inclusive experience and really not even like really trying to do inclusion. You just wanted your kids to experience what everyone else was experiencing.
Right.
So, where did it go from there as far as the eSoccer goes? And the E in soccer stands for everyone, is that correct?
Yeah, well, it's not, people have added their own things, but it stands for the time exceptional.
Okay.
And for us, it was, that was a phrase, not a word at the time that was used a lot for kids programs, and now that it tends to stand for what the person who's attending thinks it stands for, but we started expanding for super exceptional. And that was because what we were trying to say is this program is different than all the other programs. We can take anybody and we can help anybody have the experience of what we call inclusion today. And
right.
What happened is we started at a park. We started at the middle school across from my house, so many people started joining that we had to move to a park that was fairly big. So many people kept coming that we ended up moving to the largest park in a city called Foster City, California, where I lived. While we were working there, we ended up maxing out, I think, at about 100 to 125 kids. And these kids were coming from all areas of the Bay. Some people were driving an hour to an hour and a half to get there on a Saturday because they said there was nothing like it. One of the unique things that happened to me at that time, when we were about at 125, was that a couple came walking by and stopped. And they kind of were inquiring about who was in charge, which nobody really was in charge, but I was sort of the one who got things rolling. We had many coaches, you know, it was a team effort. But they were sent to me, and they said, hey, we just wanted to say we really love your program. I said, oh, you do? And I said, you have kids? He said, well, no, we don't have any kids at all. I said, oh, how did you find out about the program? They said, well, we were driving by it. We were looking for houses, and we kept driving through the various communities, and we kept coming here, and every time we came here on the weekend, we would see you out there, and we thought, this is the kind of community we want to be in. We want to be in a community that has kids together, especially civic kids. So we ended up buying a house right there across the street because we loved your program so much. And the city of Foster City was great. They didn't even charge us for the field. We became sort of, and we're still there to this day, we sort of became a part of the community. And then so many people were coming from other parts of the Bay that we were forced to start other ones just because we felt terrible. We were driving an hour, an hour and a half.
Right.
So now it's probably closer to about 400 to 500 kids every Saturday come to these various programs. We've had college students, a newspaper at San Jose State wrote about the program because the kids who began with me in 1996-97, those kids are now all college age or nearing graduation or just graduated.
Uh-huh.
And so they launched clubs on the campuses they went to. Different ones went to Cal, San Jose State, and a lot of the students in these places started versions of e-soccer there. So it really has been stunning. And along the way, I think one way that the state of California sort of, and I guess nationally, they sort of paid attention and a sense of encouragement to the program and hoping it would spread is I was fortunate enough to get the Jefferson Award, which is started by Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. And several of sort of the Kennedy group in awarding for community service and work done to effect positive change in the community. And then it coupled with that, Congressman Lantos in California, the late congressman, I thought it was a joke when I first got the call, but his office tracked me down. I was like, we want you to come on in. We want to give you a congressional citation. And I was like, I didn't even know what that was all about. And the guy who called me was at my office. I was on the road. He said, hey, Congressman Lantos wants you to come to his office. They decided to give you a congressional citation. And I thought he was playing a joke on me. And I go, I don't believe this. I mean, you're not going to get me. And it turned out to be true. So I went down there and I asked Congressman Lantos, I asked the chief of staff, I go, why did you even pay attention to me? I'm just that little, you know, a program here. That he said, because these are the kind of things that make our community better and what we want it to be, and it only comes from people doing things in the community. And I thought that was very telling, and it's a lot like what I've seen you do in your work, which is the same thing. The government can only do so much, and money, honestly, can only do so much. People can do a lot, and so it's been thrilling. It's gone to now. There's different ones in Africa. The one in Las Vegas, the first time they held theirs, they had 400 people come the first day.
Wow.
So that one was outstanding, and we have a number of other cities that are beginning to launch them and wanting to launch them. And the good news is they're all different kinds. The television opportunities we've had to be on TV spread around in the web have helped a lot of parents and families decide to launch their own versions. And so that's been very, very rewarding. I've learned a lot. And the biggest thing I've learned is there's something incredible about parents of typical children that sometimes parents of special needs children just don't always know. And that is that we have so many parents of typical children who say we want to be a part of it because we want our kids to grow up in an environment and a world that's diverse and where they need to give back and not just always think about taking. And I've had kids of executives that are very high ranking in Silicon Valley. Their parents bring them. They say, I've got one reason I'm bringing my kid is I don't want him to only know this world that we're in. I want him to know a world of serving and giving. And so it's been very encouraging and rewarding to see all the ways that it's spread and changed lives.
That's fabulous. I want to know about if there's any sort of restrictions on who can participate. I know that would be kind of interesting with an inclusive soccer program. If there's kids who want to participate that, hey, you know, have some, you know, real significant challenges, whether they are, you know, either physical, whether they're, you know, in wheelchairs or, you know, or if they have some significant behavioral challenges, is that something that you work with or is that planned out? How does that work?
That's a really great question. I'll answer it and try to give you a little sort of background in how we get volunteers, how we train them. But, you know, in all these years, and it's a little bit out of my control what happens everywhere, so I can't speak for every single program that's called eSoccer, but the ones we do here in the Bay Area, we've never had anybody that we turn away, and we probably get, you know, fewer people who have a physical disability that is significant. We don't get a lot of kids like that, but we do get some. And our attitude is this. I started off with a program that trained. I was a lot more rigid than the guys are today, and probably that's good. But I wouldn't let anybody get on the field to work with a kid until they trained for 5 weeks. And so you had to be on the sideline, watch, and learn for 5 weeks. And then I had physical therapists, occupational therapists, and special education teachers who were part of helping me train our coaches. Our coaches all get trained still, but they do it over a weekend now instead of over a five-week period, which is it's. But in that time, we sort of show them how do you work with kids who have behavioral challenges. So many times when parents who have behavioral challenge kids come, they assume they're going to be rejected, but they're going to try. Mm-hmm. And we don't do that. We have usually, out of every, let's say, 10 coaches, there's 3 to 4 who are experienced and have worked with kids who have different challenges. The thing we try to ask the parent to do is let us work with the kid onto the field and let the parent step back a little bit. Some parents are insecure, uncertain about that. But our group's gotten to be pretty good. It's one of the most important things, I think, when kids come who may have something in their limits that make it appear as though they'll be difficult to work with. A lot of times, their difficulty to be worked with has to do with the attitude of people receiving them. Mm-hmm. And that's what we teach all of our coaches, that if you address or approach a kid who has behavioral challenges, assuming he's going to do something wrong, jumping the moment he does something that seems wrong, then you're going to automatically set him off. So we spend a lot of time explaining sensory issues to our folks. A lot of times, getting them to take responsibility. Like I do this with my kids or other people's kids. If a kid has trouble, I try to first question myself: did I approach too quickly? Did I not, you know, did I not know the kid well enough? Have I not gotten enough advice from the parent? And then we'll do things where, like we've had things where the kid comes. And for the first 3 weeks he comes, he sits on the sideline with his parents and the worker. Then the fourth week, he walks out on the field 5 or 6 steps. Then the fifth week, he walks out on the field 12 steps and kicks a ball. And sometimes it'll take us about 3 months, and the miracle is then he'll come on that third month and he's out there playing with other kids. So that's kind of how we handle those challenges.
That's wonderful how you are able to, I guess, convey that to the people that you work with and that take the time to do that. Not only in, quote unquote, special programs or, programs where students with disability, children with disabilities are involved, but in schools, I wish people would take the time to talk with teachers or paraprofessionals about how to deal with challenging behavior because, I hear stories and I read stories and I see things with my own eyes that if only we had that background knowledge, we would be able to handle those situations a little bit better. And I'd like to kind of transition us from talking about eSoccer to Hope Technology School, which you had a hand in founding or creating as well. Is that correct?
And I think it was a team effort, and my wife, Silicon Valley was booming in the 90s, and we happened to be living here. A number of our friends from all of the different walks of life, many of them were having great success, and I went to a graduation of a private school in Los Angeles where a friend of mine was, his daughter was graduating. And it's a very exclusive school, meaning extremely well known. And so I was invited, and I was close to family, so I said, hey, I should go. And I went, and we sat with family and friend, and the speaker got up in this beautiful campus. It's a high school level school. This beautiful campus, this sunny day. I think Leonard Nimoy was there. A number of actors and actresses, Disney executives are walking around. I'm looking, I'm like, hey, I know that guy from a magazine,
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those situations where you wonder, how did I get up here? But, so I'm sitting there, and then the commencement speaker gets up on stage, and he begins to talk about the school. And he says, when I went to this school, we didn't have all these beautiful buildings. It was a set of trailers up there on the hill, and everything else was mud. Everything else was mud. And it was, being developed and being built. And he said, and that's where this school began, and that's where I learned. And he's speaking to all these kids, of course, didn't go through that period. I turned to one of my friends, and I said, you can start a school. I mean, if that's all it takes, it's five or six trainers, you can start a school. It never occurred to me before. Mm-hmm. So I came home and I was talking to my friends, and I go, it's amazing. You can actually start a school if you wanted to. It can be done. And I started talking. My wife was like, we got to do that. And of course, the first question you ask is, how do you pay for anything? And it's intimidating because, I grew up in public education. And my kids were in public school, and I was like, how in the world do you do that? Because you see all the infrastructure, and you think it's impossible.
Mm.
But when we talked, and my mother was a teacher, by the way, and she was one of my first calls. And I said, hey, Mom, can you start a school? And she said, you can start a school. It's not that hard. I said, I didn't sound hard to me. I know I couldn't teach. I couldn't teach ABCs.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, no, you can do it. And so it became pretty clear that the friends we had, they were all like, hey, let's do it. We'll all pitch in, and we'll be able to raise the money. It's doable. We know people. You know people. Let's just talk about it. And we were able to put the money together. And once we did that, my wife, she took the reins and developed, recruited the teachers. And she started off with one class that was experimental over the summer to see how it would go. I think an even number of typical and special needs kids, and there was an elementary school in the Bay that their student population dropped so much that a third of the building was empty, and somebody we knew found out about that, contracted with them. She recruited it, so I think two or three classes, started with three classes I think after that summer, and from there it grew to I think it's K through eight now. And, I mean, she's got a set of fair educators. I mean, I don't have anything to do with the running of the school, but she's got a set of fair educators and teachers that they got their accreditation, their California accreditation, recently finished it, and they marveled at what had taken place at Hope Technology School. Because they said one of the quotes was, "Your peer educators are rock stars." Because they've got more than a few peer educators who have master's degrees, and they were just stunned. And so, yeah, it's inclusive. It's I forget the percentage. I think it may be 60% typical, 40% special needs. It's got speech therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists on campus. They work there, great administration, great parent group, it's inspired me, not really about private education, but kind of what you've been talking about today and what you've talked about and written a lot about. What's possible when teachers and parents get on the same page and work together, and the parents respect what the teachers know, learn from them, and the parents and the teachers pull from the parents what they know. It's been extraordinary to watch, and I think it's a vision of where education will go in the future in public education.
Yeah, I agree. The potential that is there when teachers and parents are on the same page, and that there's trust that is built. I think that is a big key to what is missing in when we have. When we have IEPs that are, 5 or 6 hours long, and advocates and lawyers and all this stuff, I've written about that before. That it's a trust issue, I think, because if we did trust each other, and if we did have open communication, and we were on the same page, then we could go a lot farther. Which sounds to me like what you're trying to do with Hope Technology School, and also is starting so small, I think with public education, it's so hard because it's such a big system, not just district wide or not even just school wide. You get your district and then you have the state. And then you have the federal components, and no one seems to be talking to each other.
Well, it's interesting because the public education system takes a beating sometimes from different places.
Right.
Having grown up in a family with a mother who worked in public school, my dad wasn't an educator, but my mom was. I was taught before I got to school,
mm-hmm.
and my view of educators and teachers is pretty, I have a high degree of respect because I watch my mom, work all day, come home and take care of us and then go back and work all day. And I went to a suburban school that was going to take part of the community. It was, it was great. And she wouldn't teach in my school system because she felt she wanted to help African-American kids in the inner city who really needed the help, and that people out where I was in school didn't really need the help. And what I learned then and believe now is, when you get the teacher empowered in the classroom, be able to do the kind of work I know a lot of teachers can do, and they have the support of the administration, in this case, at Hope Technology School, I've seen is the support of the administration and behind their ideas, and then they also have the support of the parents and everybody gets input. It's shown me because there's some teachers at the school who, they were in the public school system for a little while, but it shows me why. I saw a study recently where it said that a number of teachers in private education aren't actually making as much money as teachers in public education. And I think one of the reasons for that is, if you get a little bit less money, but a lot more freedom, and your life is easier and smoother, and you get to see the success of your students, that's attractive, I think, to teachers. But I look forward to what happens in the classroom. But yeah, when you're talking about three levels, what I equate it to Apple computer, where that's right here, right? I live in the shadow of it. one of the things they talk about there is that when you walked in, if you had to make a decision to make something great happen, it used to be at a company, they had to have 5 studies and all kinds of red tape, but Steve Jobs would walk in and go, let's do it and let's start now. And in smaller environments, in certain private school environments, if you can just move so much more quickly because the students, the teachers have the ability to say, hey, I want to do this in my class, and then it's done. They came to me, one of the teachers came to me and said, hey, you guys are doing Digital Scribbler. Can we get the software in here? And we need iPads. And we talked to people at Apple, and people volunteered to donate some iPads. And I think within, you know, like 7 days, they had the iPad. This is a while back. 7 days, they had the iPad, they had the software, they're up and running. Just things like that where they can happen. I'm looking forward to that one day, an education system where a teacher can make the call of what he needs to do for his students, and he doesn't have to go through 7 or 8 different layers and fill off different forms. I know I'm probably idealistic and dreaming, but, you know, it's my hope.
Well, you know, we can all be that way, I suppose. You know, I definitely have my lofty dreams about education, and, you know, in particular about public education. You know, there is a place for public education. It's unfortunate that we have to work so hard at, you know, getting the things that we want. And it does take a long time. It, you know, just to, you know, we're talking about technology. You know, this is just a little example, but I have a particular software that I use. I'm not going to, you know, promote it or anything, but, you know, I didn't have the updates for the software. It's not like I can just go and download the updates. You know, I have to have someone else do that for me, you know? Yeah. And, you know, and also, everything is blocked. You know, we don't have just free internet, free reign on the internet. Everything is blocked and filtered. So things and websites that would be of good use that I can use, I cannot use, or informational websites, you know, I can send to my colleagues, you know, they can't see that or read that at school. They have to do it at home. So that gets a little frustrating. You know, we just have to do the best with what we have, unfortunately.
And it's complicated, obviously. So I think, you know, the truth is everybody faces some challenge, but that's part of the reason we wanted to start the different programs we started. It's not as much as I was happy in the public school system for myself. My wife went to public school for my kids while they were there. But at some point you want to innovate, and sometimes I think the best way to get things started is have some examples, some examples of it. Because when you have those small, shining examples, hopefully, they'll eventually have an impact. And that's why I like, you know, I wanted to just, you know, take a moment to say, that's why I like what you're doing and what a lot of teachers who are on the ground making a difference, I like what they're doing, because there's nothing like, for someone like me who develops software, I depend on the great teachers in both the typical classrooms and in the special education classrooms, the inclusive classrooms, to tell me what they need. I wish I had more time to make more of what I hear is needed, but I think probably, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to be on your podcast is because of all the work I see you do. And I get inspired when I look at it, because I think, you know, if we can get in the hands of teachers like yourself and others the tools they need and give them the freedom, I think a lot of things get taken care of in the education system. I think the hard part, as you said, is when as long as it's big, it's hard for that to happen. But you may sometimes be plowing away as you write articles and mobilize people like me and parents to contribute and collaborate. You may wonder if it's making a difference. And I talk about you at least, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks here with somebody about either something I've read on your site or you've ended up interacting with someone I know. And I also, with regard to how hard I think you work, because I watch it, and I go, you know, it reminds me of my mom. My mom didn't just work at school. She was spending my toy money in her classroom. and I knew it. You know, I was like, my mom, she insisted that, and she says to me today, my classroom is going to be the best classroom as far as design and inspiration and energy and things the kids like, if I have to pay for it myself. And sometimes we didn't get what we wanted because she said, hey, I had to get posters for my classroom. You'll have to wait. And that's how I learned about public school teachers. So I just wanted to say while I'm on here that thank you for what you do and for all you write and the way you mobilize. Some days when I'm doing all the different things I'm doing, I think I can't write another word. I can't do another thing. And then I'll see you posting something new or getting some new writer. And I'll be like, oh my God, I'm going to get off my butt and do something. And that's how I think change happens. I don't think anybody's going to walk. I lived in D.C. 4.5 years and worked there. And I don't think anybody's going to walk into the door of the White House and change things overnight. It's going to be people on the ground who are in the classrooms. And there are a few people I admire more than teachers and that are in the classroom interacting. I've encouraged a lot of people I've known to become teachers because I tell them, look, I remember – I can name you my teachers, Mrs. Sherman in fourth grade, you know, Mr. Wood in fifth grade. I can name the profound teachers, Mrs. Young in ninth grade. It changed my life. Mm-hmm. And I there's nothing as rewarding as that. Whenever I go back to my hometown, if I ever run into any of them, you know, it means I'm always impacted by how much it means to them that I've done something useful with my life. So I wanted to say that your Think Inclusive work is the reason that I wanted to get on here and talk, because I admire what you've done and all the effort you make, the creativity. It's outstanding, and I'm not sure you get to hear that enough, but I've been feeling that a long time and haven't written you an email, so I thought your podcast would be a good place for me to just interject and say, my stuff's nice, but I really think what you're doing is even more amazing because you're actually in the classroom on the front line, and I'm, you know, developing software is not nearly as challenging as teaching kids and negotiating that environment. Thank you for all you do. I want to make sure I said that.
Thank you very much, Russ. It means a lot coming from you. I have a mutual respect for you as well, and the work you do with Digital Scribbler, and also with the QuickTalk AAC, which actually I have that on my iPad. I wish I used it more. It's just not something that I'm able to right now. But I have shown it to other people, so it's good, you know. And I, like I said, you know, I appreciate those words very, very, very much. Sometimes it's hard to know or gauge, you know, what kind of impact you're having when you're a blogger. So, but you know, it's good. I have this kind of cognitive dissonance every time I go to work because, you know, I'm in a self-contained environment. And I have been since my first day being a teacher. But I've always had this inclusion mindset, with my kids. And even when I taught in Pasadena, California, I taught 4 years in a self-contained autism class. So I would, you know, take my kiddos and we'd go into fourth grade general ed for a math segment, or, you know, we would go and, you know, when I first got there, they wanted to have us go into this separate into the preschool playground to play. And I'm like, no. No, we need to be out with everybody else. You know, we need to mingle and, you know, we can't be invisible, you know? And it was just a different mindset, you know? And I tried to really, you know, buck the system as far as that goes. And I continued to do it. And sometimes, you know, you get the feeling like you're being annoying.
anytime I learn, this is the historical truth. Anytime change has come, it has rarely been comfortable for the status quo. And I think that as the world becomes more globalized, we experience this. We live in a very globalized city in the Bay, or a set of cities by the Bay. And you have people from all different walks of life, you know, all different languages. You sit in a coffee shop here, you could be anywhere. You could be in Europe, you could be in Latin America, you could be in Africa. It just, because you're hearing that language. And it reminds me that the world is increasingly getting diverse. And those who think that people with special needs or physical disabilities or any kind of human limit are not going to be part of that inclusion, I think that's a mistake on moral ground, and that it just isn't the way to build a healthy society. But it's also a mistake on sort of creative breakthrough ways. I think if they had meant for, say, special needs kids, there's a lot of the technologies that I think are beginning to explode a little bit that people would not have the passion drive to build. I've been to and talked to developers, engineers at HP, at Apple, at Google, and I've yet to meet one who didn't become more impassioned about what they were building because they found out a child without language, a child who was more isolated, was able to make contact with people emotionally, was able to be included with people socially because of their technology. The HP TouchSmart, I sat in the room with all the engineers who developed and built it, designed it, and they were stunned when they found out what we were doing with both typical and special needs kids in the classroom using it. So I say all that to say that when you're on that playground and when you're doing those things for those kids, we need teachers to do it because we're not going to have fewer people that have unique needs or disabilities. We're going to have more. And I know every time I go to the hospital for a checkup or whatever, and I'm walking through the clinic, there's typically in a hospital or a clinic, there are sick people who are pretty sick. And you realize that at some point, everyone is going to need to be included. And if we develop a society that's only for the completely sick, we have no weaknesses, then eventually everyone is going to be outside of it. So I think when I see you out there, you know, pushing to make sure your kids are accepted, I think it's pushing society to say, you know, we can't just say it's only for people who can survive because they're the fittest. It's got to be for everybody, and there's something we all gain from it. And that's one of the reasons I stay driven, is I just think it's not going to work. I was that kind of kid growing up, to be honest. I had my academics, my sports, my grades, my scores on tests, you know, what schools I wanted to go to, and I had all that, and I kind of ignored everybody. Got to college, and I realized when I was in college that I went from a small town to the city of Boston. I realized, wow, the world is bigger than my small bubble, and that was a process of change. By the time I had kids with special needs, I had already pretty much bought into, you don't just build your exclusive little world. But once I had kids with special needs, I said, look, this whole issue of if you have talent, you're great. If you don't, you're not. That's out the window. I got to erase my whole frame and start all over, and I'm glad I did. So when I hear what you're talking about, I go, just keep at it. Every teacher and parent keeps at it, because society is being influenced every day.
Yeah, well, thank you. I definitely think that, speaking with different people so far on the podcast and other, you know, just conversations, I think that the changing kind of your heart and mind about what inclusion is really going to be the thing that's going to change people. Because although research is really great and research can be useful, especially in the school system, because they make everything, they pretty much make all decisions based on research, you know? But the teachers that are in the classroom that are working with the kids, if there's a way, if there's a video I can show them, or if there's an article by a self-advocate I can show them, or if there's an example I can give them about how you can include a student with significant disabilities in a typical classroom. I think those are where the really big aha moments come. And then it was the same thing that happened with me when I went into my teacher training. I thought there's no way I could, include a student with severe autism in a general education room. There's no way. Why would that ever work? And it wasn't until my professors and my, educators that were telling me, actually it can, and this is how you can do it. And, these are the steps. And then once I saw it, I was like, oh, well, that's not at all what I thought it was going to be. Or I totally understand that, And, in fact, I remember when I first got into my education program, and I was picking like my classes, and I had my advisor, she had mentioned inclusion, especially for students with significant disabilities, and I was completely against it. I said no, that they need specialized instruction, they need to be in a safe environment, and I was saying all the things that I hear when when I bring up the conversation. And she's like, actually, no, you should, check this out, read this, look at this. And slowly but surely my eyes were open. And now there's no way I can go back to where I was, because I've seen with my own eyes that it can work. It doesn't mean that there isn't challenges, or that, there's certain environments that aren't ready, for our kids, and that's real. That's a real discussion. But, to say that it doesn't work, or to say that, it'll never happen or whatever, that's just, because we haven't seen it yet. So,
yeah.
Well, this has been a really great discussion. I wanted to kind of wrap things up and give you a chance to maybe plug some of your stuff. I know eSoccer is moving to other kinds of sports. I didn't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, or if you wanted to talk about Quick Talk AAC. I'm happy to plug that.
Yeah, if people want to check it out, they can search for eAthletics, or they can go to my digital scribbler, www.digitalscribbler.com, and check any of it out. But I actually came on just to be able to have a great talk with you. I've enjoyed the podcast, and I don't need to advocate for those things. I'm excited to encourage people to listen to your work and read your work and follow you more often. So that's why I wanted to be on.
Well, thanks a lot, Russ. I appreciate it. If anyone is interested, they can check out digitalscribbler.com, I believe. And then you also tweet at Digital Scribbler, or is it _ Digital Scribbler? I can't remember.
That's right.
And then you also can Google eSoccer. There's a lot of really great information about that. So thanks again, Russ, for being on the program.
Thank you very much. Sounds good.
That concludes this edition of the Think Inclusive podcast. For more information about Russ Yule and eSoccer, you can visit his website, digitalscribbler.com, or on Twitter at @D_Scribbler. Remember, you can always find us on Twitter at @Think_Inclusive, or on the web at thinkinclusive.us. Visit our sponsor at brookspublishing.com. and receive 25% off your order using promo code TIMBD25. Today's show was produced by myself talking into USB headphones, a MacBook Pro, GarageBand, and a Skype account. Bumper music by Jose Galvez with the song Press. You can find it on iTunes. You can also subscribe to the Think Inclusive podcast via the iTunes Music Store or podomatic.com.
the largest community of independent podcasters on the planet. From Marietta, Georgia, please join us again on the Think Inclusive podcast. Thanks for your time and attention.